World Football in Qatar is the podcast taking you behind the scenes with all 32 teams at the World Cup. We're hearing from the players, the fans and people in Qatar, telling the truly global story of the competition. That's World Football in Qatar from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Living in Space on the BBC World Service with me, David Baker. We're the world's radio station, and today we're going to be taking that idea even further. Step outside one night and look up into the sky.
We need to sit down and have a dialogue with regards to the future of space.
In amongst the stars, you should be able to see a tiny red dot, Mars.
When a crisis comes, you cannot live on the Earth. Probably space would be the better choice.
200 million kilometers away, the next planet in our solar system feels impossibly distant.
And everybody will be under a lot of pressure there because of the way we're living so far from home.
But we've already landed robotic crafts on its surface. And in the not-too-distant future, we'll be building human settlements there.
It's time for a new kind of astronaut, the younger generation. It's time for them to go out and not only explore the new worlds, but to settle new worlds.
And when that happens, stepping out on an evening won't just mean gazing up at the heavens. It will mean people in the heavens gazing down at us.
The company vision is to build the infrastructure and the foundation that enables, eventually, millions of people to live and work in space.
In this program, I'm going to be asking what human settlements in space will be like, who will be living in them, and how they'll be organized.
We have to think of a solution that is good for the entire human race, not just for one race or for one country.
Our first stop is a lot closer to home. Bristol, a city in the southwest of Britain, among the crowds milling around on the harbour side on a sunny September afternoon.
Inside there's hydroponics, which are plant based.
Plants are being grown hydroponically without soil, which might be a way that you would grow plants on Mars.
We're in our hydroponics research area, so we're surrounded by a few plants that have been grown here, and they've all been chosen for their sensory qualities. So they're plants like sage, lemon balm, and there's a big basil plant behind here.
My name's Ella Good. I'm an artist, and I am leading this project with my friend and fellow artist, Nikki Kent.
Hello.
The project is called Building a Martian House. It is a prototype of how you could live in a house on Mars.
Ella and Nikki's project is a continually evolving work of art, exploring what it would be like to live on another planet.
The lower floor, that would be part of your rocket that you travel there with all the life support systems already in it, so that the people who arrive, they don't have to build their own life support systems, and they know they definitely work because they've survived the journey. So that is what the lower floor is, but then you want more space than that when you live on Mars. And that's why having an inflatable design really works, because it packs down very small and is very light. And then when you get there, you can inflate it and fill the walls to make them thick and filled with the Martian regolith so that you can protect yourself in some way from the radiation as well.
Ella and Nikki think all of us should be involved in working out how we will live in space.
We've been working with engineers and scientists and architects to talk about the feasibility of the building, and then involving the public and families and school children to talk about how might you live in it. And we thought we'd come back to the house today and start here, just so we could kind of reflect on what we've started.
And I was experimenting with human hair. This is something that then I created.
Once a week, Nikki and Ella invite anyone who wants to come and actively design the actual features of this Martian house. These workshop participants create designs that will meet the needs of the fledgling community they imagine themselves to be part of on Mars.
Well, how would a new community in this new place function, how it could look really different to how we live on Earth.
And how does that reflect in how we work together here?
And everybody will be under a lot of pressure there because of the way we're living so far from home.
You need, like, to have people around that will help you out, because that's what you were referring to. It's literally just describes collaboration as a whole. Sharing is caring.
It's a social contract to decide how we live and function together, because I'm a firm believer that can't really decide by committee, because that kind of dilutes good ideas.
Whatever kind of governance system we have has to be a lot more survival focused than we're used to thinking of.
Speak in private, you only speak in a communal place, and then you can't have subgroups, and you can't have gossip, and you can't have lies, and so then you only speak when you're in the communal area, and then everybody knows nothing else has been said outside those walls.
The first community on Mars would probably have to be sterilized, so no babies on Mars for this first batch of people. I don't know how ethical that is, but it doesn't mean, for example, in terms of females, that you don't menstruate or you don't feel like you want to mate with someone. So I was wondering how to make space for activities like that, because this is just a basic human need as well.
Building this Martian house is a work of art. But there are good reasons to believe human dwellings on other planets could become a reality in the near future. The US government's NASA, the world's biggest and most powerful space agency, plans to establish a base on the moon as early as 2034. And it has ambitions for a human mission to Mars just a few years later. The prospect of human settlements in space means we have to start thinking about some very different issues than the ones that have shaped and dominated space exploration so far.
Everybody thinks, we are too busy thinking of the science and the technology. We can ignore for the time being the societal issues or the sociological issues. We have to start now. I'm Bazlan Othman. I was formerly the director of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs in Vienna, Austria. I was also the founding director general of the National Space Agency of Malaysia.
Maslan argues that we need to have a much wider and a much deeper debate about what kind of communities we want to build in space.
A lot of people believe that whatever inequities that exist on Earth will be exacerbated in space. We have to think of a solution that is good for the entire human race, not just for one race or for one country. There is a moral issue here. It's not just about having the cultures being different in space, but who should we allow to go to space? Would we leave all the poor people from the poor countries behind because they cannot afford to pay $100,000 or $250,000 for that trip? We will have to look at the best talent, and the best talent is not only coming from one country or one creed of people. We need to think of how we can build some kind of diversity.
And she says, we need to think about why we want to go and live in space in the first place.
What is the motivation for us to set up such a settlement or habitat in space? And I believe it might be one of two. The first is that there is some economic activity that is critical or vital to sustain an economic activity here on Earth, and it's vital for the whole human race. The other motivation is that the planet Earth is doomed, and that the human race, in order to survive, will have to leave the Earth. You know, it's been said that if the dinosaurs had a space program, they would not be extinct today.
In the past, space exploration was limited to big nations with big budgets. Think of the American Apollo missions or the Soviet Union's Soyuz program. But now, many countries on Earth have space initiatives, and indeed many private companies too. As I found at the biggest and noisiest annual global trade fair for space exploration. I've come to Paris to the International Astronautical Congress, a huge convention of space specialists, which is taking place in this enormous convention center here in the center of the city. Over about four floors, I can see all around me stands from pretty much everyone who's involved in the exploration of space.
There's NASA over there, there's India, there's the UAE, there's some European countries here, the European Space Agency, of course. And if you really want to understand what the thinking is about the future of space, this is the place to come.
Tomorrow, when a crisis comes, you cannot live on the Earth. Probably space would be the better choice. I'm Sudhir Kumar. I'm Director Capacity Building and Public Outreach from Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO.
We're just looking around the corner at, there's a big chart about India's first manned space program. Could you tell me a little bit about that and why India's looking to go into space or send a person into space?
The sustainability of the humankind is obviously a question. And today you are comfortable on the Earth. But after some time, probably you have to explore. Maybe after 100 years or 200 years or 300 years, people would prefer to go beyond the Earth for their survival. That is one thing. The second thing is, very important thing is, we should know what is happening elsewhere. So what is beyond Earth is a subject of concern to protect ourselves. Tomorrow we do not know, solar system, let's say different kind of asteroids are coming, they may hit us. How actually the system outside to protect ourselves? Technologies which will enable the people to go into space and live in an autonomous manner will give lot of spin-offs to the human society. Tomorrow water is depleted. How to survive in the low crisis situation? These are all the technologies that are very much important to develop, which can be scaled for the spin-off applications.
And it'll give you the return here back on Earth or in space or in both?
Both.
And Sudhir sees a big role for business when it comes to space exploration. We're on the India state stand, but, you know, over there there's Lockheed, there's different companies all around us. How is that relationship managed when it comes to our colonization of space, the commercial and the state?
They're complementary to each other. The government should act as some kind of supporter, mentor, rather than builder. The building, we have to do building-based manufacturing, assembly, testing, we should leave to the industry.
In the past decade, there's been spectacular growth in the number of private companies getting involved in commercial space exploration. They're not only providing the rockets used to launch satellites and promoting space tourism, but they're also making plans for establishing a longer-term human presence in space.
So that this amazing experience can actually become real for people who are not space people.
Right, and so everyone has the potential to be a space person, so I think that's the first thing we can say, right?
In one of the huge dark presentation halls in the Paris Conference Center, we found Blue Origin, the space company founded by Amazon's Jeff Bezos.
We're still entering a new world as we do this commercially.
Brent Sherwood is Blue Origin's Senior Vice President, Advanced Development Programs.
The company vision is to build the infrastructure and the foundation that enables, eventually, millions of people to live and work in space.
Brent says we need to go through three stages that will take us towards permanent settlements in space.
The first step is what I call adventure travel. Spaceflight is still high risk, it's very expensive, and you can think of an analogy like a very high-end adventure travel vacation, climbing Mount Everest or going to Antarctica. You know, it's risky, but it's curated. The step after adventure travel is genuine tourism, and the step after tourism is living. I would anticipate the beginning of an ability to live in space in the 2030s. A model I like to think about is a timeshare condominium in orbit. Say 12 people own a month each out of the year of an apartment in orbit around Earth. That's a very special address, quite amazing houses. And we can begin to think about what it will mean for people to live, at least for part of their life or part of the year, in space.
It sounds idyllic. A timeshare out among the stars. But life in space, whether it's orbiting the Earth or further afield on the Moon or Mars, will be much harsher and much more dangerous than the conditions we're used to here on our home planet. And that's likely to have a big effect on the kind of societies we build there.
There is a lack of freely available liquid water, a lack of natural food, and of course, an atmosphere that's either toxic or no atmosphere at all. I'm Charles Coquel, and I'm Professor of Astrobiology at the University of Edinburgh. Climate and the environment that people will inhabit in extraterrestrial places will shape the sort of societies that they make.
Now, I'm asking you to hypothesize, but can you give me some for examples here? You know, if it's a dangerous situation, does that lead to a particular group or a particular group function?
Yes, well, imagine you're on the Moon or Mars, for instance, and you can't just go outside and breathe the air as you can on the Earth. The oxygen that you breathe comes from a manufacturing process. Even if you own your own oxygen-producing machine, the parts in that machine are presumably serviced by someone else. And that means that something absolutely vital to your existence has elements of control from other people. And as a consequence, I think, there are enormous potentialities for tyrannical control over those commodities to control the population.
Freedom or human rights might take second place to survival.
In the space environment, protecting people from the lethal external condition is paramount, and any right or claimed right of freedom can be looked on as trivial compared to this need to survive in the extraterrestrial environment.
What can we do politically to avoid just a bunch of dictatorships in outer space?
A limited range of goods and machines is an excuse for political control. And the best way out of that, a little bit like autarky on the Earth, is to maximise the range of goods coming in and out of a settlement. And that speaks to reliable spaceships travelling through the solar system, allowing for this free movement. Essentially, what you want to do is transform the solar system into a free trade zone. And that will enhance the conditions for liberty in otherwise isolated settlements throughout the solar system.
That free trade zone will create a big role for the private sector in space. And companies are already seeing a commercial opportunity in the imminent decommission of the International Space Station, or ISS, a kind of floating science lab that's managed jointly by the US, Russia, Japan, the European Union and Canada. The ISS has been orbiting the Earth since 1998, but by 2030 it'll come to the end of its useful life. And according to Blue Origin's Brent Sherwood, its replacement, or replacements, will have a very different business ethos.
8 years from now, the space station, according to current plans, will be decommissioned. And that's critical because it means the scientific research business that's currently conducted on station needs to move to one or more commercial space stations. That then becomes a kind of anchor tenancy of a commercial facility, which then enables us to build that facility to be a mixed-use business park. And that's certainly the model of our space station program called Orbital Reef. Without the prospect of a genuinely commercial business at the end of it, nobody's going to invest. A combination of governmental public action and private enterprise. That's certainly the way we do it in the West, and I expect to see that continue to open the frontier in space.
So what would those private space stations do?
There's both tech and non-tech industrial applications. So that could be products that can only be made in microgravity and then return to Earth. It could be entertainment products like making films in the zero-G environment. It could be gaming, for example. There's no casino on the International Space Station. It's a government facility, but gaming is a big business around the world. There are ideas that people are already working on for biomedical products that could only be made in space. A classic example that people talk about these days is growing organs for organ replacement, because in microgravity, you can suspend in a kind of containerless way some tissue culture. So that may turn out to be, growing corneas, for example. That might be something that works better in space.
The effect of microgravity on biological processes is a massive area of research in space exploration, and one that could have profound implications for the future of human life away from the surface of our planet. As I found when I stumbled across a stand in one corner of the vast Paris Exhibition Hall,
Hi, gentlemen. David Baker from the BBC. This is obviously an important event.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah, what's going on here? What's going on?
Okay. Hey, my name is Ismir Yamin. I'm from Independence X Aerospace. So we are a new space transportation company. Yeah, so what we do is mainly on space vehicles, re-entry vehicle and also launch vehicle. But in this case, today with me today is Dr. Egbert from Spaceborne United.
Dr. Egbert Eilbroek. I'm working with Dr. Yamin in a collaboration. We're going to sign an agreement today. Spaceborne United is my company, which is focusing on researching and also enabling different stages of human reproduction in space. So in a few years, we aim to enable the very first conception of a human embryo in history, conceived in space and not on Earth.
Because of the lack of gravity, cells behave very differently to how they do on Earth. And that goes for sperm and eggs and embryos too. The technology Egbert and Ismir have developed is designed to see if it would be possible for an egg to be fertilized in a zero-gravity environment and for an embryo to grow.
At the moment, we're focusing on the beginning of reproduction, so that means the conception stage, conception and early embryo development, so the first 5 or 6 days.
So what we can see here is it's a clear plastic disc which has reservoirs and canals built into it, and you can see how that will be spinning around. Where does the sperm start and where does the egg start before the spinning starts?
The egg starts on the reaction chamber.
Here on the outside, on the edge.
On the outside of the disc. And the sperm cells begin in a chamber more close to the center.
Okay.
We are facilitating artificial gravity by placing the embryos on a rotating disc. And by adjusting the spinning rate of the disc, we can adjust the gravity level that they are experiencing. And as soon as the disc inside the life support system is in low Earth orbit, in space, then we will reallocate the sperms in the disc and send them to the female cells. And in each chamber, we plan to have 3 female cells, so there will be 12 embryos, potentially, if the fertilization works well.
And when do you think we might be seeing a baby born in space?
We could see that in about 10 to 15 years.
Private companies are also about making profit, as well as cost effectiveness.
Yes.
Is there a profit to be made out there?
Yes, definitely. It's a huge profit to be made, because what we are doing here is not only helping to understand how human can grow and sustain in space, but there are other things as well. Like, for example, the development of vaccines, antibiotics, and other biotech specimens. They actually perform better in space, especially when you're talking about protein crystallization that are essential for vaccination making and stuff like that. Their efficiency is close to 100% because of the microgravity effect.
And will we be seeing a new generation of billionaires who make their money in space?
Absolutely.
With such a commercial approach to human settlement of space taking shape now, I can't help wondering whether this will cause tensions with other space powers who might have different priorities and values. Or indeed whether those without the money to invest could be cut out of the market and the benefits of living in space altogether. That's what I'll be exploring in part 2 of Living in Space. Welcome back to Living in Space on the BBC World Service, with me, David Baker. We're exploring what human communities will be like as we venture out into space and begin to settle there.
I am Giuseppe Ribaldi. I am interested in space in 61 years, and I have spent 35 years with the European Space Agency, and in the last 10 years I've been starting a number of activities, including the last one, the Moon Village Association.
Backed by big space corporations such as Lockheed Martin, the Moon Village Association is one of a number of international groups now debating what human life among the stars could actually be like. Giuseppe sees here a big opportunity to reshape the way we live together.
We will have an opportunity on the Moon to have a new start. We have an heritage of our history of several thousand of years, but the Moon is giving us a chance to start again nearly from scratch, not really from scratch, but give us an opportunity to rewrite some of the way of behaving.
That opportunity will come quite soon. Both the US and China have plans to build bases on the moon in the next 10 years, and that will raise challenges.
Right now, relations between the two countries are not exactly cordial.
The present political landscape is not extremely, let's say, positive. And so there again, the Moon Village Association has started an activity to try to bring together different blocks, to try to talk to each other, to try to find a common level playing fields, to try to understand each other and interact with each other.
When you look at what we've done on planet Earth when we humans have moved into new territories, let's face it, it hasn't always been pretty. It's been a bit of a wild west. There's been aggression, the powerful have won, the person who has the most force has got all the resources. How do we avoid that happening in space?
It is also the difference between access to limited resources or unlimited resources. And as you know, as we have seen in many historical background, when you have limited resources, you are about to doom, because the fight between the people for the limited resources will inevitably bring to the end. Access to space resources, Moon, Mars, and so forth, gives a chance to everyone to have, as I said, unlimited basically resource, which it is a condition necessary but not sufficient to limit the wars or to limit the conflict.
But even with unlimited resources, we're going to need to find a way of regulating how we live together in space, not only on an individual level, but also when it comes to relationships between states too. And the laws we have at the moment may not be up to that.
We need to sit down and have a dialogue with regards to the future of space, especially that a lot of the laws and legislations and common agreements towards space exploration or utilization of space has been drafted decades ago when there were very few players operating within the sector and most of them were nations operating there. I am Sara El-Amiri, Minister of State for Public Education and Advanced Technology in the United Arab Emirates. I'm also the chairwoman of the UAE Space Agency.
How do we work out who owns resources they take control of or they discover in space? I mean, in low Earth orbit, I can kind of understand that if I had a private satellite, I can charge people on Earth for access to the information that it gathers. But what about when I'm on the moon or on an asteroid or something? Is that resource the whole of humanity's or is it mine?
You can't dictate policies based on who gets there first.
But in fact, there's a good chance, on the moon at least, that those first arrivals will get to decide how we live there. And that's because of the way the regulation of space has played out so far. Space exploration is covered by two global treaties, brokered by the United Nations. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty says that space should only be used for peaceful purposes, and that access to it and its benefits should be open to all. That treaty has widespread international support and was signed by all the major space powers. However, none of the major space powers has signed the 1979 Moon Treaty, which proposes that no one can claim ownership of territory or resources on any celestial body in space. That makes places like the Moon, asteroids, and Mars much more vulnerable to exploitation by whoever gets there first.
Is this something that should be opened up to all of humanity or something that should be owned and exploited by just a few entities or companies or nations?
What would you like to see included in it? What kind of discussions would you like to see taking place?
I would like the whole aspect of ownership to be kept open and not defined that whoever gets there can cordon off X number of kilometers and be able to explore in it and not open it up to others. So that's the first aspect that needs to go into place. And that ensures that as you're going and defining it, you don't sequester it to a particular group of people.
And without proper regulation, many, like Edinburgh University's Charles Coquel, think there's a real chance of tension or even conflict in space.
People tend to think of space as a place where there are limitless resources, so it's ridiculous to talk about two settlements fighting each other in space. But it's actually not the case. If you go to the moon, for example, the readily available ice on the moon is localized to the permanently shadowed craters of the South Pole. There are also places in the South Pole of the Moon where there's permanent light, where if you stand on the rim of a crater, the sun goes round and round on the horizon, a bit like in Antarctica, and you get constant light. These are fantastic real estate locations if you want to build a settlement with permanent light. So there are places in space that are extremely rare and could be extremely sought after. And in those places, we could imagine the potential for conflict and disagreements.
Namrata Goswami, a researcher with a deep knowledge of the Chinese space program, as well as those of the US, India and the UAE, agrees that we're lacking a global agreement about how we should operate in space.
I haven't seen a regulatory framework coming out of the United Nations that actually takes seriously the kind of conversation we are having, which is space settlement, which is about resource extraction.
Instead, we have two very different agreements. The US's Artemis Accords, which about a dozen other countries have signed up to, and a Chinese initiative that extends that country's Belt and Road program into space. That initiative is supported by more than 140 states, including Western nations such as Italy, Austria, and New Zealand, and could, Namrata says, lead to conflict about how disagreements in space are policed.
The Communist Party of China might actually establish a unit on Mars that reflects back some of the legal stipulation of the commercial international court with Chinese legal system dominating. And we know China does not have an independent judiciary today, so that would depend. Will that judiciary be independent? Would it be completely politically motivated to grant a case to one particular actor vis-a-vis other?
Unsurprisingly, the US is also concerned about the growth of Chinese power in space. Bill Nelson is head of NASA.
If you're going to have international cooperation in space, you've got to have transparency. Even with the lack of transparency of the Chinese space program, and in particular, I'm talking about what they present as their civilian space program, even since they have not had transparency, and I can give you several examples if you want, but nevertheless, we have had cooperation, for example, in deconfliction of some space activities in and around Mars. So will that blossom into a greater relationship? Well, that's up to the Chinese. Thus far, they have been unwilling.
But others are more optimistic. Professor Yun Zhao, a specialist in space law at the University of Hong Kong, sees no conflict between China's Belt and Road Initiative and the UN's Outer Space Treaty.
I'm Yun Zhao, Henry Chen Professor in International Law and Head of Department at the University of Hong Kong. My research area is mainly on space law and dispute resolution. The Outer Space Treaty has a provision regarding the jurisdiction and control within the space of their own station. So within the station owned by the United States, the American legal regime will govern the activities that take place within their station. In the Chinese station, the Chinese law will apply. So the jurisdiction control has been well provided in the Outer Space Treaty.
In the most recent space white paper that China produced, I think updated it in January 2022, there are quite a lot, maybe even half a dozen mentions of the Belt and Road Initiative in space. Now, the Belt and Road Initiative, as you know, is quite a national initiative from China. How does that fit in with the international nature of how space exploration will take place?
The Belt and Road Initiative is one very important initiative that was put forward by the Chinese government. But if we look into the Belt and Road Initiative, the essence is to emphasize about the international cooperation, which is exactly the most important principle in outer space regarding the space cooperation and also the multilateral regime. So that's why there's no conflict in between Belt and Road Initiative and international cooperation in outer space.
And Maslin Othman, formerly the director of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs in Vienna, says China's aims are much less nationalistic than they might appear. She had direct dealings with the country when she was Director General of the Malaysian Space Agency.
If they want to set up another China in space, then they wouldn't talk about international cooperation. Why bother? For China, for instance, when they were talking about their station on the moon, they have gone out to a lot of countries. I have been approached by China, and many countries have been approached by China to see how can they expand, you know, the interest of other countries in their project. You're going out and reaching out to the developing countries, you know very well that they're not going to bring in big investments. So I believe a country like China is looking for maybe diverse inputs into their program, because I think everybody agrees that diversity is a strength.
Not everyone is so well disposed towards China. Some people think that Chinese geopolitics right now are very much like the imperial colonialism that we saw in the past. And Maslan thinks that we should not go down that route again.
So we can learn from history. So I think, again, being the optimist, if we know we have made mistakes in the past, how do we learn from those mistakes? You look at what is the definition of colonization. It includes one party taking over the domain of another country, or in this case, another planet.
Those who have come from a post-colonial, they've dealt with colonizers and shrugged off the shackles of that. And this is how they think. Their way of thinking will be very important. I'm Nnedi Okorafor. I am a science fiction and fantasy writer, particularly African futurism and African Jujuism.
Nnedi's novels imagine a future in which humans move out into space to work and to live. Drawing on her Nigerian-American heritage, she's acutely aware of how human history is scarred by the experience of colonization on Earth. And she's worried that if we don't listen to the voices of people who've been colonized, we'll just make the same mistakes in space.
The problem is the hierarchy that is involved in just leaving the planet. You know, so there's already that. It's already in place. So you can see who's behind building the technologies to leave the planet. They're the colonizers. So therefore, they're in control of the programs. So therefore, they pick and choose who goes and how, you know, all of that. So you've already got the attitude and ideas of colonizers in the DNA of space travel. So that flaw is already embedded in the way things are being done.
And can you give me a sense here how the mindset and the attitudes of people who've experienced being colonized themselves will be useful for making new communities in space? What kind of things will those voices be saying?
People who come from colonized societies will be able to recognize that, and they'll be able to be like, okay, I've seen this before. I know what this is. I know where this is going. I know what comes next. It's going to be this. First you name something, and then you start mobilizing groups against that something. And it's just kind of that slippery slope that we've seen before. They'll be able to recognize it most, and hopefully they'll know to speak up and be like, this is problematic and this needs to stop. I think that those who come from societies that have dealt with, for example, genocide, they'll know the markers of that, and they'll be most passionate about stopping it.
So far, space culture has been dominated by a hierarchical and military-led mindset. The extreme conditions of space and the huge cost of space travel have concentrated efforts into the hands of nation-states and their militaries. But now, Nnedi argues, it's time for us to think again and build a different way of living together.
Just a simple hierarchical structure is not going to work. It will eventually just duplicate what we've seen before on this planet. I guess I don't really know what the name of what I would consider that works would be, but it would be more of a web kind of thing that utilizes everyone's skill and utilizes and prioritizes everyone's skills. And everyone will come with different skills.
In your Binti novels, you have a heroine who brings ideas from space back to Earth to change things here. I wonder if that's going to happen in reality when we're out in space. Do you think how significant might communities in space and the culture that they have be if to influence society here on Earth?
The mirror that it will hold to Earthlings will be so powerful that I think it will be, whatever is learned from that experience that I think Earth people will have to listen.
I really love your optimism. I must admit, perhaps it's late in the day and I'm feeling a little bit cynical about it, but it's a bit like, you know, when you go traveling, isn't it? And you come back to your hometown mm-hmm. and you can see so many things. And you really want to tell the people in your hometown, oh, no, what about this? What about this? What about this? But they often don't listen, do they? They kind of feel, who's this uppity outsider who's gone away and now telling us what to do?
True. But that's why you need to have a storyteller on board. Because storytellers, well, a storyteller will be able to translate. They'll be able to translate all the experience from that Mars colony in a way that Earthlings will be able to hear and enjoy. So the enjoyment will be like the sugar that will attract and make for people to want to listen.
If someone asked you if you'd like to be the storyteller on that one-way mission to Mars, what would your reaction be?
That's the kind of possibility where it's like, because I'm terrified of that idea, but it's like, if it were presented to me, I'd have to accept it. Like, I would totally accept it. I totally would.
Not everyone, though, is so keen to go into space. And that includes people whose day job is in the space industry.
My name is Didier Schmidt. I'm working for the European Space Agency, where I'm in charge of the strategy and the coordination of the space exploration program. Why would people want to go to Mars and live there? What would they do? It is like going on Earth to a most extreme desertic area, and you have to imagine you're in near vacuum. You can only go out of your home, so to say, with a heavy EVA suit, which is probably about 80 kilograms. Of course, it weighs less because of the gravity, but still, it's awfully cumbersome. You cannot scratch your nose, you know, when you have an EVA suit on. And what would people do? That is the question. You know, we hear about this, that we have to become a multi-planetary species and so on. What for? What would people do on these planets which are so hostile?
They'll be in extreme environments, and we kind of know what they'll be like. But what about when later we start to build villages or towns or cities? What kind of societies will we be building in space, do you think?
Of course, you hear things which are a bit outside of the imagination today, of terraforming, changing the environment of Mars and so on. I think this is a very, very big mistake and a very counterproductive statement and initiative, because it says de facto, for those who have the chance to be extremely rich and maybe powerful, they have a plan B for our planet if something goes wrong. That is a very negative message.
Why is it a negative message, apart from the inequality message?
Because the message is wrong, because we shall not talk about a plan B. We shall take care of our planet and our children on this planet.
Space analyst and author Namrata Goswami disagrees.
The argument that I hear people making is that why don't we first get Earth right? Right. But you see, that also is a very Western value oriented argument. I hear this a lot from my Western colleagues telling people from the other side of the world, for example, my African colleagues that want to have a good lifestyle, that want to develop themselves, that they shouldn't, because that would lead to the depletion of Earth or would repeat back some of the bad behavior that, say, Western civilizational move with capitalism has brought to Earth, right? Or my Indian colleagues and or my Asian colleagues, right? And so I would argue that we could do both. We could actually, by moving out to other settlements, we could improve life, we could offer much more access to resources.
And as we move further and further away from our planet, our view of events on Earth will change. Blue Origin's Brent Sherwood.
What we find is when people fly in space, they change. Their perspective about what I would call human hubris changes, because it becomes viscerally apparent how insignificant any of us is. And especially the contrast between the inherent lethality of the universe and the precious
biosphere in which we evolved and live and, you know, the nest that we're currently fouling, so to speak. That's a very impactful experience to people. So I hope that as the overview effect is able to be experienced by more and more people in the future, it will fundamentally change how people view what are in fact very trivial conflicts on Earth, very parochial conflicts.
In fact, in the future, the humans who live in space may well develop very different cultures of their own.
Space is very, very big. Distances are enormous. And there is a fundamental limitation, which is the speed of light. So in a world in which we have space settlements distributed around the solar system, there won't be real-time phone calls. There'll be email, right? Asynchronous communications. But I believe the right way to envision that distant future with millions or trillions of people living in the solar system is there will be communities which may have hundreds of thousands or maybe even a million people each, but they will be distributed in such a way that they are effectively islands in space.
That's a view shared by others, such as Charles Coquel, professor of astrobiology at Edinburgh University.
But I suspect very soon, once you live in those conditions, independent cultures will emerge. I've spent 8 years studying the politics and sort of political philosophy, if you like, of the Hebridean Islands off the coast of Scotland that are small populations of a few hundred people. And I've gone out there and spoken to people about the Moon and Mars. I've studied those islands just informally on holidays, specifically with respect to space. These are places that are connected to the Scottish government and indeed ultimately the UK government. And yet each island has its own particular culture, its own way of doing things. And I suspect that although you can think about building a China or an America or an India on the Moon or Mars, once those people are physically there, the culture in those habitats will very quickly take its own trajectory.
The prospect of creating a fresh human culture away from Earth fuels the dreams of many, as it has done for as long as humans have told each other stories. Nnedi Okorafor's novels are powerful explorations of such a dream. But artists Nikki Kent and Ella Good, creating their Martian house in Bristol, are finding their evolving design means they're increasingly less attracted to living in space and more focused on improving things here on Earth.
You can imagine this sense of excitement. Sometimes you might imagine, like, oh, I'd like to go and live in the middle of nowhere, or, you know, like go and live on an island or go and live in the woods. So it is that scenario in a way, but to the such an extreme that I think you would just feel too disconnected from anything, from people and sounds and nature and life. I would be scared of the lifelessness of the landscape.
I'm not done with hope on Earth, so it's not about not wanting those things. I actually do believe that we can all change. I do think it's very difficult because it's so big to think about here. That's the problem. It's such a vast thing. And then when you shrink it down to individuals, we feel separate from each other. That's what the artwork's about. It's a way of us talking about how can we make these things, what do we want.
The idea of like building a new community from scratch, I mean, is that even possible? You know, like, how can you start from scratch? Because we have so much experience and we live where we do and we live how we do, and you can't like just draw a line under all of that and begin again. You can't pretend like people are like blank canvases and we're not going to take anything with us.
Look up again into the night sky, at the moon, at Mars. Those distances are so huge. But we humans are finding ways of crossing them, just like we've done throughout human history in those earlier migrations here on Earth, journeys that made humanity what it is today. Personally, I'm not at all convinced I'd like to live in space. I feel very attached to the planet we're on now. But even considering the possibility, I think does something important. It gives us perspective.
And as we try to work out how we might build new worlds out there in the solar system, I'm wondering if it's also now the time to reconsider how we live together here on Earth. So that, when those citizens of space look down on us sometime in the future, we can be sure that we'll be proud of what they see. Thank you for listening to Living in Space on the BBC World Service, presented by me, David Baker. The producer was Jonathan Brunet.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from.
Whatever you're looking for in a podcast, the BBC World Service has something for you. From untold legends, Aura, tracing the story of a gifted black sportswoman's struggle for recognition in segregated America.
Aura was an athlete at a time when the world wasn't really paying attention to African-American athletes.
The Coming Storm, investigating the rise of the QAnon conspiracy theory threatening American democracy.
A world of parallel realities, an epidemic of disorientation.
When everything that you thought was true about things is shown to be false, you kind of question everything.
To season two of The Bomb, uncovering a gripping true story of espionage at the heart of World War II atomic research.
Klaus Fuchs was the perfect spy.
He'd given the Russians the plans to the plutonium bomb.
This was going to change the world.
You can download and listen to Untold Legends, The Coming Storm, and The Bomb in full now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.